Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening this morning. In this first hour of the show, we will be returning to a topic that we have discussed on other days with other guests, but from a perspective that's a little bit different. We'll be talking about some of the implications of the Human Genome Mapping Project. Our past conversations have mostly been with people whose background was biology, sometimes scientists, sometimes journalists, sometimes people who actually were both. This morning we'll offer a little bit different perspective, that of a social scientist, and our guest is Barbara Katz-Rothman. She's professor of sociology at the City University of New York. She is the past president of an organization called Sociologist for Women in Society and the Society for the Study of Social Problems. Her previous books include these, Recreating Motherhood, In Labor, and The Tentative Pregnancy. And we'll be talking this morning about some of the things, the ideas that you will find in her book, The Book of Life, which is subtitled A Personal and Ethical Guide to Race, Normality, and the Implications of the Human Genome Project, a book that was originally published a couple of years back and now has been reissued in paperback. It's published by the Beacon Press in Boston. And Professor Rothman is joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions certainly are welcome. Questions, comments, welcome. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief. We ask that so we can keep things moving and try to get in as many different people as would like to join the conversation. But certainly anybody is welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You match the numbers with the letters on the phone, and you get WILL. So that's another way of thinking about it, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Rothman, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
I was struck by one of the things that you write in the introduction to, or the preface to this new edition, and that is one difference perhaps between the way people thought about this in 1998 when this first came out, and now is that it seemed to you that people were now more willing to question this research and its implications, that perhaps people have a little bit more in the way of reservations about all of this.
I think so. I hope so, but I also think so. When I started doing this research, when I started really tracking the way that the public was hearing stuff from the human genome, it was entirely in terms of next big miracle around the corner, you know, about to cure this cancer, that cancer, about to live forever, make perfect babies, that a new gene had been discovered for absolutely everything, you know, alcoholism, schizophrenia, the gay gene, genes for intelligence, genes for anything you'd want or not want. And those articles are showing up quite regularly. When I sat down with the file of clippings I had to write the preface for the new edition, I saw that actually the articles on things to do with genes were as likely to be calling themselves genomics and showing up on the business pages. It was about patenting all of these genes and patenting all of these tests and so on. And Americans tend to be kind of awed by science. I guess everybody on the planet tends to be kind of awed by science, and oftentimes with good reason, but tends to be kind of skeptical about marketing, and also often with good reason. So when this shifted to a big marketing project and we began to see what kind of money was involved, what kinds of hopes there were for profit more than for cures or whatever, I think people began to be a little more skeptical about the whole project.
Mm-hmm. One of the points that you address in the book, and as you say now, I think coverage of this issue addresses more and more, is the extent to which it's driven by commercial concerns. Not to be too flippant, but in going and looking just to try and find out if there was anything in the way of big news recently on the Human Genome Project, I was looking back here through the archives of the New York Times and came up with a story from just recently about the fact that researchers in France have, in their own way, trying to better the civilization that we have deciphered the genome of cheese starter. It's the most widely used milk fermenting bacteria in the cheese industry. Now, I suppose in their defense, we would say that also it happens to be a member of the family of bacteria that includes the bacteria that causes meningitis and pneumonia. So one might say, well, that might have some applications. But in this particular case, well, it's just about making cheese. And that it does give one pause to think, is that really what's going to drive so much of this genetic research? It is, can we come up with something that we're going to be able to essentially to make money on?
Sure. And I think the concern that all this hoopla and all this talk about progress is really about bringing you better cheese is one thing. What I think is beginning to penetrate and make people a little nervous is that the same values, the same marketing, the same kinds of decisions, the same profit motive is going to be what's driving bringing you better babies. And so, you know, questions about what kind of research is and isn't going to be followed through in human research is going to be driven by the same people who are making the cheese decisions.
Mm-hmm. It certainly seems to be the case that this is an example, and there are many, that we have this tendency to, when new technologies come along, to be enthusiastic about them, to adopt them, and then only afterwards start asking this question, was this really such a good thing to do? And it seems that we have a rather bad tendency to not to ask these questions just because we can do something, should we ask them before we start doing that thing?
Well, you got to sort of disentangle a little bit about who's we, you know.
I take your point.
It was a really great idea. No, actually, I didn't. But the people who made those machines to, you know, keep track of the heartbeat of astronauts or whatever, found there weren't that many astronauts, but there were a lot of fetuses in labor, so maybe they could use the technology for that. So then they aggressively sold it because they had this product and they wanted a market for it, and they thought, well, what would be a good market? And then they sold it. And then, sure, like, you know, some time goes by, 10, 15, 20 years, the data comes in. Actually, this is a pretty lousy technology for routine pregnancy. But now it's all over the place. It's kind of entrenched. So we get enthusiastic. We, you know, some do, some don't. But certainly people who have the technology for sale get enthusiastic about it.
Well, I think also there is a media issue here. There's a way in that sometimes I think when new technologies come along, I think in our reporting on them, there's a little bit too much cheering and not enough skepticism.
Sure. I mean, gee whiz, gosh golly.
Right.
You know, they can do that, you know, approach to things. And that too, though, it's market driven. You know, they don't suddenly issue press releases saying, the data's not what we thought it was going to be. This isn't as good as we thought it was going to be. Actually, this isn't working. The press release is, we've got a new toy. And come look at it. Come see it. We've got something new. And sure, the press follows that.
It seems that in our thinking about it, maybe here again I'm thinking of the way that media talks about this and the way that it appears in the popular imagination, as we think about what is it that makes us who we are, we seem to go through cycles and swinging back and forth between wanting to say it's nature and wanting to say it's nurture. And that we're now in a phase, it seems, where definitely we're into nature. And as you say, we seem to be inclined to believe that everything is genetic. Is this, do you think, just another swing in this pendulum, or are we at a fundamentally different place now in the way that we think about this than we have been before?
Could I say D, all of the above?
Yes, you may.
Good. You've got a swinging pendulum, but it doesn't go back to exactly where it was. Mm-hmm. It shifts. The discussion shifts. We certainly have a more sophisticated understanding of both nature and nurture. And one of the things that's kind of interesting right now is that while on the one hand it is absolutely true that I can find you 10 articles on gene found for whatever, saying that whatever characteristic you want is in the genes, in the blueprint, predestination, written in right there at the moment of conception, I can also find you an enormous amount of fascinating research suddenly going on about newborn brain development, about the ways in which the very subtle notion of an environment, not just an environment like, you know, more arsenic in our water, say, But even an environment like the hormonal status of other body cells, and that consequence for the brain cells, for instance. So look at very micro environments. So understanding of nature has shifted, our understanding of environment has shifted, and it seems to be an easier story to say we have found the cause of whatever, than to understand that most things in life have lots and lots and lots of causes, and it's really hard to disentangle and find the single thing that causes whatever it is, you know. And usually the things that we're looking for are conditions we'd like to do some fiddling around with.
Mm-hmm.
So they look for the alcoholism gene so that they could find a different way of treating alcoholism. They look for the schizophrenia gene to find a different way of treating that. And, of course, that makes some of us pretty scared when they start looking at the gay genes or whatever other genes with an eye towards fixing people.
Well, that I guess that also gets at this question, a question that is, does it, when you take something that we're concerned about, say that it is alcoholism, and if we can identify a gene, if we can say, see now this, we really know what causes this thing, and this is it, does that somehow reassure us? Does it make us feel better about that particular problem, knowing that we have that kind of explanation?
Well, I guess at some level it must, because we keep doing it. We have found the gene for alcoholism. One of my colleagues was counting this, Peter Conrad, and I think he said we found the gene for alcoholism 20-something times in about 15 years, and we found it on the front page of the newspaper, and then we proceeded to lose it on the back page. that we found and lost that gene. It's been very slippery. It's gone along with the manic depressive gene and the schizophrenia gene and whatever. That keeps being found, and then, oh, never mind, wrong. So we must really want it for something. One of the questions is, you know, do we want it because it would remove a kind of individual responsibility? You know, my genes made me do it. It's kind of an interesting idea, because much of human history has involved an awful lot of evil done to people for things that were very definitely understood to be genetic, race, and saying just because people's condition, quote, is genetic, that'll make people be nice to them because of it. It hasn't worked so far, historically. So some of us worry about the politics of thinking that finding something is genetic is going to get rid of individual responsibility and therefore make people treat it better. Some of the question has been, I mean, one of the forefronts of actual use of genetic technology has been prenatal diagnosis. So that finding out that an embryo in a test tube, you know, on a petri dish, or an embryo or early fetus in utero has the gene for whatever particular horrific disease or some condition one would not wish on anyone, is a kind of testing and then selective abortion that we've been doing. So some people worry about, you know, what are the consequences of finding genes for alcoholism, obesity, the gay gene, whatever, when the only actual use right now might be towards not having such people born.
Mm-hmm. We have this morning here as our guests on the telephone, Barbara Katz-Rothman. She's professor of sociology at the City University of New York and has authored a book that explores some of the implications of the Human Genome Project. Her book is titled The Book of Life, and it's now been reissued. First came out a couple of years ago. It's now available on paperback edition published by the Beacon Press. So if you're interested in reading some of her thoughts on the issue, you can certainly head out to the bookstore and look for it. Your questions also are welcome. We have a caller we'll get right to. Others are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our caller here, first caller, is in Urbana, on line number one. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
You're talking about being responsible for what we're doing, and certainly there is a perspective that would say that currently we are a random roll of the genetic dice. And you could make the argument that until we organize our own genome, that we're not being responsible for what we are. we're just letting the dice roll where they may and come up with what we are. And we think that that's something magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, some people think that what we are, whatever that means to you, is, quote, genetic, that it's there in that roll of the dice. The geneticists are not making that argument. The geneticists are always talking in terms of probabilities and likelihoods and whatever. One example that I'd like to use is if you look at identical twins who have the same genome, and then look at some of the more fascinating differences between them. And I'm not just talking about subtle mushy-mushy things, but, for instance, there's one kind of diabetes that's understood to be genetic. It's caused by a gene.
You're going way off in a different direction.
No. Here's the
notion. You're still a German Shepherd if you're a German Shepherd. There are lots of German Shepherds. You're still a human being if you're a human being. Even if you're twins, you know, German Shepherds are very inbred. All right, you can't buy anything for the American Kennel Club that hasn't been inbred for generation after generation after generation for 100 or 200 years or however long they've been doing that. Same with the roses you buy at the store and the grass you buy for your lawn.
Right.
That doesn't make them identical, and nobody's talking about being identical.
Okay, it implies, though, a kind of level of control. It also, let's go back, the control issue I was saying is because, you know, one twin has the gene for diabetes, the other identical twin has the same gene for diabetes. If one has the diabetes, is actually sick with the disease, the chances of the other one being sick with the disease are only like 30%. So you have the gene for, it doesn't mean that you're going to have...
You're not addressing, well, listen.
Okay, let's go back to the German Shepherds of the Roses.
No, caller, please, we did not interrupt the caller and when he was making his points, and I was trying to suggest to him that maybe he might let the guest speak without interrupting her, but he didn't want to play that way. So anybody else who's listening, by the way, you can call
him.
Anyway,
yeah. He's raising a good question.
Yeah, go ahead.
German Shepherds and roses and, I guess, cheese... fermenting yeast and whatever are very inbred. They're bred for a very specific purpose. You know exactly what you want from them. And, you know, a rose is bred for scent or for shape or for color or whatever, and I don't know enough about German Shepherds, but those two were bred for some purpose. There was an idea that they wanted from a German Shepherd that was different from what they wanted from a Maltese or something. The trick about thinking about breeding human beings would be you'd have to understand what the purpose was. And what is it you want the person to be? What is it we want of people? And that's where the real difference is between breeding German Shepherds and breeding people.
Well, I think also the point that you made, and you write about it in the book, is indeed when geneticists talk about the relationship between people's genetic makeup and what this person turns out to be, that, and you write about it this very well, that what genetics has to offer us is a prediction, and it is not a prediction of 100% accuracy. So one really does have to go back to this question. Well, supposing that you decided you did want, that you were wanting to do eugenics, whether it indeed would be possible to do that, or at what level it would be possible to do that, so that the end result turned out to be, setting aside whether or not it's a good thing to do or not, whether the end result would turn out to be what it is you wanted it to be.
Yeah, and when you look at breeding for a purpose, the narrower the purpose, the better your shot at it is. You know, if you want to breed for very specifically for a particular odor in a rose, you can probably get there. Our notions of what we want out of people are so much more complex than what they smell like that it's really hard to put together this, it's a roll of these 100,000, now they're down to 30,000. It's a roll of 30,000 genes that interact with each other, let alone with all of the environment. And so the predictions that geneticists make are always very, very much in terms of probabilities.
Let's take another call. This is Terre Haute, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I think I was kind of following up on what you started to say right there. That what we define as a problem and try to relate to a gene, the genetic system may look at it very differently, that it may be an involvement of several genes, it may be an involvement of what controls the expression of those genes and things of that sort. And so as we define problems, characteristics, and so forth, the genetic system doesn't necessarily define them the same way.
That's right. I mean, there is this notion that you have the blue blueprint is what they like to call it. And it implies that if you just follow the blueprint, you know what you're going to get. And that if, you know, 10 people all go out with the same blueprints to build the same cabin, they'll all come up with the same cabin. It'll all have the door in the same spot, and it'll be the same cabin 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the way this works. This is much more complicated than that. I often like to think of it not in terms of a blueprint, but more like a recipe, that if you were to bake bread, say, same recipe 10 different times on a sticky day. We're having a sticky New York humid day today. The same bread will come out heavier than if you bake it on a drier day. If you bake it with wheat from one part of the country, it'll have one kind of taste. If you bake it with wheat from another part of the country, it'll have another kind of taste. That you're looking at something that's much, much more complicated and nuanced. And there I'm simply talking about a bread. But even there, the interaction, the environment, the context in which something is created shapes what it turns out to be.
Exactly. You mentioned the gene for alcoholism. It may be a very subtle interference or interaction of several genes or so forth, in that so as we define alcoholism as a problem, there may not be a gene that matches that.
Given how many times they've lost and found and lost that gene, there probably is not. I mean, there is probably not ever going to be the gene for alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably going to be a cluster of things that might increase the probability of a particular population having higher levels of alcoholism than another group of people. I mean, you may be able to talk like that. But that's a way different thing than saying this child has the alcoholism gene, and so this child runs an inordinate high risk of growing up to be an alcoholic. That kind of prediction we're not moving towards.
Exactly. That was my point. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. About midway through already this part of Focus 580, just real quick again, our guest is Barbara Katz-Rothman. She's professor of sociology at the City University of New York. And some of her thoughts on the subject are in the book that we mentioned. It's titled The Book of Life. The subtitle is A Personal and Ethical Guide to Race, Normality, and the Implications of the Human Genome Project. It has now been reissued in paper by the Beacon Press. It's in the bookstore if you'd like to look at it. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Just for a second, I want to ask you to maybe amplify on something that you also write about in the book, that where you write, genetics is as much an ideology as it is a science. What does that mean?
Well, that there's a value system here, and you could hear it in some of the things that the readers were saying, that this is about, you know, your first caller said stuff that made me think of that, you know, that this is a value that we must control our destiny, that we must take control of the random crapshoot that is life, that the control is to be had via science, that if we want a better world, the way to get there is to make better people. And the way to get better people is to look inside their cells and get better genes. It's a real interesting ideology. It's a way of thinking about the world. It's not the way the geneticists think about genetics, okay? But in our culture, oftentimes what you have is the notion that if we wanted a better world, we needed to start with ourselves and better people, and that we could do that by getting rid of genes we don't like, alcoholism, crime genes, whatever. The other way of thinking about the world is the problem isn't actually the people that we've got, it's the way we've organized it. And that if you want to make a better world, you would need to do some social reorganization. And so we don't have poor people because there are people who have the gene for poverty, but we have poor people because of some of the ways that we've permitted capitalism to develop, for instance, in the United States right now. These are really very different ideologies, ways of thinking about how the world works. The genetics as an ideology has been part of America for a very long time. The eugenics movement that came to its, you know, full, I don't know what word to use here, its full power, I guess, under the Nazis, started as American. I mean, it started a wonderful, bizarre quotes that just seem so counterintuitive about Germans saying, oh, we wish we could pass the kinds of eugenics laws the United States has, but Germany would never stand for that, you know, that the U.S. was so far beyond anything Germany could dream of all the way through the 20s. So the ideology that the way to get a better world is to get rid of these people that are not good and get ourselves some better people, seems to permeate a lot of our thinking. I mean, I've heard people talk about, you know, infant mortality, oh, it's very high among blacks. So what we should really do is compare the white United States with Europe and then say, see, we don't have a problem, because then our infant mortality rates look fine. Our problem isn't the structure of poverty and race in America that creates infant mortality. Our problem is black folks.
Yeah.
That's deeply eugenic, racist thinking. And it's one of the directions that genetics goes as an ideology.
Yeah. And as recently as not very long ago, whenever it was, the bell curve was published. That's not just something that one would say, well, we thought that way in the 1920s.
Oh, no. I mean, within the year, race, evolution, and behavior by Rushton was mailed to every member of the American Sociological Association, saying basically the same stuff as is in the bell curve. Also, no new data, none of the new genetics, it touches any of this, okay? Because the new genetics, if you look at what the scientists are doing, what the geneticists are doing, the new genetics tells you there's no biological category as race. It's not a useful biological category. But there's this kind of, the genetics as an ideology kind of, carries on the coattails of the science. You know, they're finding genes for all kinds of things. So surely there must be a gene that has to do with, and then, you know, you pick your category, race and intelligence, gay genes, whatever. You pick the category that you want, and you say there has to be a gene for it, because they have, after all, found a gene for deafness in a family in Brazil. You know, they find an occasional gene in a small place that actually seems to do a very specific thing. And then say, see, everything must be genetic. Hmm. There's got to be a gene for each and every one of our characteristics.
I want to mention our phone numbers again. You're certainly invited into the conversation. I had someone here who was on hold, and maybe I made them wait too long. My apologies. But anybody who wants to jump into the conversation can do it here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. There isn't a major focus in the book, a major area of interest is on race. And I'm interested in that it seems that what we now have learned hasn't had much of an impact on the popular imagination and the way that we think about race. It was not all that long ago when European scientists were looking at the world and they were dividing it up according to people's appearance, their surface appearance, and their place of origin. And they were saying, well, there were these different races. They were attributing different characteristics to them. And they were saying, well, these groups of people are all fundamentally different. Now what genetic science has taught us is that essentially the differences between people of different races are so small as to be negligible. And
well,
yet
and
somehow
not,
that we haven't quite caught on to, you know, that hasn't quite grabbed people, the idea, oh, well, okay, yeah, so we look different on the surface, but we're not. It is one race.
Yeah, and it's more than just that people, it's like there's this commonsensical notion that we have learned to see race, so we see it, and then we say, well, that's obvious. And we see the consequences of race. If we go back to infant mortality, there is no question at all that in the United States there is a correlation between skin color and the chances of the baby dying. It doesn't mean that melanin causes infant death, but racism responds to the color of the mother. Racism responds to the care she gets. Racism constructs a higher a cluster of social, economic, political, historical events that lead to a higher infant mortality in that population. So just because, you know, race doesn't exist as a biological category doesn't mean that racism doesn't exist as a social characteristic. And it's hard, it's really hard to move back and forth between the notion that race doesn't exist and the image that you have of me and I have of you and our callers have, people listening in have, that we sound white, black, Hispanic, Italian, whatever. What we've done in the United States is say, well, Italian's certainly not a race. Jewish isn't a race. Jewish used to be a race, not now. Irish isn't a race, used to be a race, not now. So there's really no such thing as race when you're talking about white ethnic races. But the Americans have a really hard time letting go of the black, white, yellow thing. And as Jonathan Marks pointed out, it's because we were sitting there in this physical place was at the center of three trade routes, and you had people who are black, white, and yellow arriving, and they looked real different from each other. If you wander through the world, you see the sort of infinite variation and the lack of a space in between. Okay, it's not that there's all these black people and then there's all these white people and then there's all these yellow people, but that people come in all different shades of skin, for one thing, on a total absolute continuum, and there's no demarcation point that would say this is this race, that's that race. America's sitting in a place where people came from three different points on that continuum and say, well, but basically race still exists. So it's really hard for the scientists to break through that little line in our head. Mm. They can tell us that race doesn't exist, but it's real hard to get people to believe it.
We talked a little bit earlier about the way that we're talking about and thinking about genes and disease, and that we seemed, that is, the way that in popular media this discussion goes, that we perhaps have encouraged in people's minds this idea there is a one-to-one correspondence between a gene and a disease, and all we have to do, if we figure out what gene is responsible for what disease, then we go from there, and hopefully we can figure out some way to fix that before that disease makes itself known. Of course, it's not as simple
as
that.
It's not working that way at all.
And who knows whether it ever will, but what are the implications, you think, of us getting into thinking about disease that way?
Well, we're living with those implications right now. We are thinking of genes more and more in terms of disease-causing entities, that this gene causes that disease. And so you would then work backwards and say, if you've got a disease, what's the gene that caused it? The media definitely has played part in that. I recall listening to an NPR story that said that they had found a gene that was involved with 10% of one kind of colon cancer, and that kind of colon cancer was about 10% of all the colon cancers. So, quick math, 10% or 10% is 1% of all the colon cancers had a relationship with this one particular gene. And I was in the car with a friend who's not as into things genetic as I am, and I just did a little unfair thing. I said, hey, what did they say? And she said, I think they found the gene for colon cancer. And that was the gist of the story, they didn't quite find it, but they pretty much found it. 99% of the colon cancers don't seem to have the gene 4 involved in it. Something else is going on. But we are putting our money into the genes, and that's going to be the big profit-making sector, too, that there's profit to be made there, to talk about environmental causes, to talk about dietary changes, to talk about changing the social world. It's not necessarily so profitable.
Hmm.
So there's not necessarily such a push to do that. And that's the consequence that we're living with. I mean, people are walking around with the notion now that breast cancer is a genetic disease. All of this talk of what they're calling BRCA 1 and 2, BR for breast cancer, 1 and 2, there being two genes that have been found that are implicated, the percentage of breast cancers caused by those genes are like 5% of all the breast cancers. People who have the genes have something like a 50% lifetime risk of getting breast cancer. So half the people with the gene don't get the gene, 95% don't get the disease. 95% of the people with the disease don't have the gene. And yet, when I talk to people, they say, well, nobody in my family has breast cancer, so I don't have the gene for it. Or my, aunt had breast cancer, therefore I'm probably going to get it. They've really somehow taken in a bizarre genetic determinist understanding of breast cancer, which nobody in the breast cancer science world would ever claim.
We have some other callers. Let's continue to talk with people who are listening. In Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Interesting discussion. I thought I'd call up and ask, since you think genetics, whether or not we proceed, kind of boldly in that area or not, kind of depends on philosophical questions almost, like what are we about and all that. What's life about? I was just kind of curious as to whether you'd come to maybe personal conclusions alternatively, if there's a particular point of view that you think is particularly attractive or admirable in terms of finding a set of facts or beliefs or whatever that would help us make the choice as to whether we should, go ahead and change our what we actually are.
You know, the first time that I started working on anything to do with genetics, and it was around the prenatal testing issue in a book I did a lot of years ago, and I started looking at, you know, what would you test for, what are you looking for, what is it you're trying to create when you're creating a baby, and I came to the point I was making to the earlier caller about I'd have to know what it's for. You know, a perfect dog is a perfect watchdog or whatever it is I want it for, but what do you want a baby for? I mean, what's its point in being? And I realized I'd have to know the meaning of life to be able to answer the question. And I actually don't know the meaning of life. And I actually haven't resolved it well in my own life. Why are we here is not altogether clear to me. What is clear to me is that we're not saying we're going to have to wait and hold off and deal with those philosophical issues and then do this. What we're doing is a very market-driven approach to this. I was on a panel at that conference connected to the UN, the World Peace Conference, whatever it was called, a while back, and there were a bunch of people on this arguing about how we had to have international patenting of genes or there wasn't going to be any research to cure cancer, because if there wasn't any profit to be made, then nobody would invest in curing cancer. And I was just sitting there, and I lost my father to cancer when he was very, very, very young. I've lost a lot of people I love to cancer over the years. I'm as cancer phobic as anybody you ever met. And the idea that if there wasn't profit to be made, there wasn't an incentive to cure cancer, just stuck in my throat. I thought, if that's not a way to organize the world. If we have organized our lives in such a way that profit is the reason people do things, and if there's no profit, we're not going to do it, then I don't think we dare to touch the human genome. That scares me to death. So I don't know how we should be thinking about this, but your point that we need to understand what we want out of life, what life should be for, what it's about before we tinker with the genome, you know, point well taken. It's not what's happening. Right now, it's like, could you find a gene for baldness? Could you find a way of changing the action of that gene? Could you make money on that? And the search is on.
And yeah, I don't think there's any question that the market's a cruel and kind of a blind way of going about making these choices. But it just seems that if you say that you first have to know kind of quote the meaning of life unquote, and then you say that that's an unanswerable question, then we've got to find some other way to make
we do have to find some other way, and it's got to be somewhere between hanging on until all is revealed or something and we understand the meaning of life and figuring out what the profit motive is. And when you talk to ordinary people, they generally are pretty clear about that. It probably is not worth investing the kind of money we're investing and taking the kinds of risks that we're taking, tampering around with genes, tinkering with the human genome over, say, baldness. And that even if there is a lot of profit to be made, don't go there. People are pretty clear. You got diseases that cause early and horrible death. Yeah, let's think hard about how best to get rid of that. And if genes are one of the ways of getting rid of that, fine. But if there are other ways of getting rid of that that are probably less dangerous, that's even better. I think people are pretty clear about this, but we haven't organized ourselves around those values. We've organized ourselves around the market.
Well, just one parting shot here, and that's that. To my mind, where faith or which I personally don't you know, have to rely on very often, I find. But I would think that if there's any place where faith has a place, and that is, to me, it's when you run out of facts and what's knowable. And this seems to me this whole question is something that bumps up against that. Thanks. Bye.
All right.
Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes left, a little bit less, in this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Barbara Katz-Rothman, is professor of sociology at the City University of New York and has written about these issues in her book, which is titled The Book of Life, A Personal and Ethical Guide to Race, Normality, and the Implications of the Human Genome Project, published by the Beacon Press. We have some other folks here. We'll take as many as we can in the time that remains. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana if you want to call. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Another Urbana caller. This is line number two. Hello?
Hello.
Yes?
On the subject of funding for research, whether it should be profit-driven or derived from other sources, it seems to me that the profit motive is really very injurious to the validity of research. Just thinking of the nutrition, where for years we were told that vegetable oils were good, animal oil fats were bad, use margarine, don't use butter. It turns out they're equally bad. And the reason we got that research was it was almost entirely paid for by the vegetable oil industry.
Yep.
It seems to me that if we fund our genetic research the same way, we're going to get the same kinds of invalid data.
A lot of people think that, yeah, that profit-driven research is a kind of a scary thing. And the subtle interplays between what's publicly funded and then what's privately patented afterwards has also been pretty scary around this. So a lot of people have participated as volunteers in genetic research, you know, giving their blood, their cells, participating as they can, and then turned around and discovered the whole thing. Then if you want to, you know, use a test, say, that resulted from that, they have to pay to the holders of a patent. And so, yeah, the implications of what the research will show, if it will show that which the holder wants it to show, and who then has access to whatever benefits there are both really morally tricky questions.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take another caller here. This is in Peoria, line number four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Yesterday on the radio they had about a lady that gave birth to twins, and they were both attached at the head. 10 months later, she had twins again, and they were also attached at the head. What would cause that? Genes?
I have no idea. I don't know that anybody else does either, but I don't know. It doesn't seem, from our understanding of how that kind of development works, it seems to be a remarkably unlucky woman, but not a gene for attached at the head. It's hard to, knowing what we know about how genes work, it's hard to picture that kind of developmental thing is genetically foretold.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions again are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Back just for a moment to the subject of patenting genes. It's something that I guess I can't quite wrap my mind around, at least in this sense, because we do know that people have done it. And it's the case, for example, if I was a genetic researcher and I went out there and I discovered the gene that caused Alzheimer's disease, then I could say, well, this gene's mine. And anybody who wants to do work in this, and one would hope that people would, as a way of understanding and perhaps treating Alzheimer's disease, anybody who did that would have to pay me money.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if there's anything where you could make the argument that something is the property and the heritage of all humankind, it's the human genome. How did we get to the point where we said it was acceptable, the very notion that someone could patent a gene?
Yeah, it's been argued. I mean, you know, the U.S. has done the patenting. There's been disagreement. Many other countries are not going along so fast. So the same genetic test, say the breast cancer gene test or whatever, costs much less in other places where you don't have to pay a royalty because they don't buy the idea of patenting. this has been the decision we've made here. And, you know, it is funny. It's like, I was writing all about this stuff. I did an article for a magazine called MAM, a breast cancer magazine for breast cancer community. And I did this article on patenting and stuff. And, I mean, I understand this intellectually just fine. I did this article with Ruth Hubbard. And the cover art they chose to use was the patent. And I was holding in my hand this patent form that had patent number 5,747,282, issued to inventor Mark H. Skolnick, assigned to Myriad Genetics, the University of Utah Research Foundation, for the breast cancer gene. And just physically holding this thing in my hand, it was nuts. I mean, it is bizarre and nuts to think that you could do that. We got there, you know, sort of one logical step at a time, but it's a fundamental shift in our understanding of science. We used to think the world existed and scientists discovered that which was there. Patenting says you have to have invented it. And so your name gets written down not as the discoverer of the gene, but the inventor. And there really is a line on the patent form that says inventor, and there is the name of the person who, quote, invented the breast cancer gene. He obviously didn't invent it. And yet, to get the profit, that's the kind of game we have to play. We have to sort of reconstruct what we mean by science. There's a famous line that always comes up when people have this conversation. Somebody had suggested to Jonas Salk that he patent the polio vaccine, which certainly would have made him a very wealthy man. And he said, oh, you might as well patent the sun.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, there's probably somebody else trying to patent the sun.
Sounds like a pretty good idea to me. I'll get on that later. We have time for at least one more caller, maybe more. Let's go to Chicago here, line 4. Hello?
Just mentioning Jonas Salk, as a point in his life, he decided to turn away from the microscope and look through the telescope and look at life in a larger sense rather than the intimate, small sense that the microscope revealed. And similarly, at the Genome Project, ultimately you get around to the question you were asking for about the meaning of life, and that would be freedom and relationships and other things that make it meaningful. So to the extent that yesterday's dream becomes the hope of today and the reality of tomorrow, we're at the verge of discovering things that will certainly either put ourselves into a greater relationship and freedom or ultimately put ourselves in the hands of masters of our destiny. So it depends on how we're going to deal with those things. I like your program, and I'll look forward to getting your book.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, we are always trying to figure out what's it about, what's the point, what's the meaning of life. You look up at the stars, you look inside the cells, you look at rocks. I mean, you look at what you look at to try to figure out what is, in some larger sense, the meaning of all of this. And then we are pretty much turned back to where this caller just said, is that, well, we are the meaning of it all in our relationships with each other and the way that we treat each other. And to some extent, when we look at a new technology, one of the questions that we have to ask is, are we trustworthy? Are we in a good enough world where we will do right with that technology? And we're getting some very, very, very powerful technologies. Whether you're talking about, you know, the technologies of nuclear weapons or you're talking about the technologies of genetics and the micro kinds of technologies, we've got some very powerful technologies. Do we have a good enough world in which we can trust ourselves with those technologies? And again, one of the notions is, well, we just make better people and we'll get a better world. And the other is that if we don't change what we value in the world, we're not going to get a better world.
There is a good place for us to stop, which we must do anyway because we're at the end of our time, to mention again the book. If you're interested in looking at it, it's titled The Book of Life, and by our guest Barbara Katz-Rothman. She is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York. Professor Rothman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.